Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, AM Hub, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia. I den her måned, der er det 50 år siden, at ørnen landede på månen, og Neil Armstrong han steg ud og udtalte det berømte ord. Det er et lille skridt for et menneske, men et stort skridt for menneskeheden. Og så spacerede han rundt på månen den 20. juli 1969. Det fejrer vi her i Tactopia med tre afsnit om rumforskning.
Okay, engine stop. System, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I sidste uge der hørte vi om et tysk rumforskningsprojekt, hvor man leder efter liv i rummet og prøver at finde ud af, hvordan livet egentlig opstod på jorden. I den her uge der skal vi møde den amerikanske forsker Lynn Rothschild fra NASA. Lynn Rothschild beskæftiger sig med at finde ud af, hvordan man kan overleve, hvis man skal bo på Mars. Hvad sker der for eksempel, hvis man bliver syg, mens man er deroppe, og man måske ikke lige har den helt rigtige medicin? Man kan ikke bare få fløjet den ind fra jorden. Ja, så er det nødvendigt at bruge syntetisk biologi og simpelthen selv skabe sin medicin. Så hun forsker i, hvordan man kan bruge syntetisk biologi ude i rummet og øvrigt også en masse andre ting. Men det kommer du til at høre mere om lige her og nu i Tactopia, hvor vi blænder op for det andet afsnit om rumforskning.
Sure, of course. My name is Lynn Rothschild. I'm a senior research scientist at NASA's Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley in California. I'm also an adjunct professor at Brown University in Rhode Island. Sure. I really wear two hats at NASA Ames. One is I'm an astrobiologist. So what an astrobiologist does is study the origin, evolution, distribution of life in the universe and the future of life. And the big question that we're all really interested in is, are we alone? So this really plays the fact that my background's in evolutionary biology, trying to understand the evolution of life and what that says about looking for life elsewhere. But about 10 years ago or so, I was directed by our center director at the time, Pete Warden, to start a program in synthetic biology for the agency with the idea that this was going to be the enabling technology for space exploration.
And then you have to explain to us, what is synthetic biology?
I'm so glad you asked. So synthetic biology has all sorts of definitions, some of which are very complicated in talking about interchangeable parts and engineering and so on. But I think that the very simple definitions are really the best ones, and that is creating something new with biology that's not found in nature. Whether it's a whole organism from scratch or tweaking a current organism so that it's able to do something or look in a way that it hadn't before. And so a really great way to think of it is that for millennia we did descriptive chemistry, and then about 150 years ago we started doing synthetic chemistry. Well, the same thing in biology. For thousands of years we have done descriptive biology. We've looked at the organisms around us and described what they look like, how they work, where they come from, and so on. Now we are doing synthetic biology, where we're making new things with life.
Could you give us some examples?
Sure. Some of the early things that were done that have been some of our best success stories were using microbes to make artemisinin, which is a huge anti-malarial. It's something that had been gotten before from trees and so on. And it's expensive, difficult to get. Malaria is certainly a huge health problem around the world. And so if you can get microbes to make artemisinin, that's fantastic. Actually, insulin that's used to treat diabetes is what we call transgenic. That's really made with synthetic biology as well.
And just to clarify and understand how you actually do it, you code biology like you code a computer.
Absolutely. So it's kind of interesting that life itself is almost an analogy to a computer. Maybe we should say computers are analogous to life, that we have our own code, our information system, but instead of a two-bit one like you would have in a computer code where you have a zero or a one, in biology we have a four-letter code where we have four nucleotides, adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, and it's the order of these nucleotides that determine our code in our bodies. And so you can then use that to make all the proteins and sugars and so on that go to make up you.
But you code this in a computer, but how do you actually turn it into actual DNA?
Okay, so we all have the DNA in our bodies already, but say you want to do something new with life in synthetic biology. Well, one approach is that you could take some of this foreign DNA from another organism and put it into a new organism. So, for example, if you wanted to engineer a crop so that resists a pest. So rather than putting a pesticide on the plants, you could engineer the plants to resist the insects themselves. You might take that gene from another organism. There are ways to amplify it, sort of like a copy machine, and put in the new organism. But at this point, some of these technologies where we make DNA from scratch have gotten so inexpensive that we are literally able to sit at our computers and write the equivalent of computer code, the code for living organisms or genes and so on. And when we're happy with what we've written, we push send on the computer, send a little money to a gene synthesis company, and they physically make that DNA into a part that they then ship through the mail back to your lab. And my point is that if you're going to be able to do that so that you're able to break this physical link between the coding information in life and the physical manifestation by going to a gene sequencing company that's across the street, it doesn't matter if it's across the street or across the ocean or off planet. Once you've made that physical link, you can do this anywhere.
And when you say anywhere, you're talking about space. I mean, you will send the digital code of DNA into space to create life?
Exactly, or to get life to do things for you. So one vision that I love is, say you have an astronaut who's been on Mars for a while and gets sick with some disease. Now, you can't take every pharmaceutical with you when you go off planet, and even if you could, they won't be able to be stored forever. You'll have to make new things. But maybe this is something that's never been found before. There's a new drug out. The doctors on the Earth could type the sequence for DNA in a computer, send that information digitally to Mars, and then I envision that there would be a DNA synthesis platform on Mars. It then makes this DNA physically. You take that DNA, put it in a cell, the cell produces the drug, and the astronaut recovers.
It does sound a bit like science fiction.
It sounds like science fiction, but there is not one step of this that I described that we're not already doing, except the part where we're sending the information to Mars, and we already send information to Mars all the time. We have rovers on Mars that we're sending instructions to every day. We have a couple of them roving around right now.
I'm just wondering, do you have all the components to do this on Mars? I mean, you have to print it, you have to have the right components.
So we have none of the components to do this vision on Mars. Right now, this vision is in my head. But someday, we will be able to do that. And that's one of the things that we hope to do is to be able to convince NASA and other space agencies and the private sector that this is the way forward. And so that when they do plan the future missions, they will incorporate this into their mission planning.
No, but what I'm thinking about is, if we accept that you can actually do this in the future, will you need some raw material on Mars that you can do it with?
Well, it's an interesting question whether you need the raw materials on Mars. One thing is you can bring everything with you. DNA is not going to weigh very much. But when you start replicating cells, at some point you need to feed them something. Now, we could send them food, bacterial food or yeast food, sugars, and so on. But at some point it would be much better to live off the land. So when our ancestors came out of Africa, they didn't bring all the materials to live in Europe for the next million years or 10 million years or 50 million years. They learned to live off the land. And when our ancestors in the New World came into what's now Canada and the United States, Central America, South America, and so on, they didn't bring everything with them. They shot the speared mastodons, and they ate plants and so on. Now, we can't spear mastodons and eat plants on Mars because there aren't any. But if we could set up a system similar to what we have on the Earth so that we have organisms like we have on the Earth, plants on the Earth and algae, that take the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the water that we know is available on Mars and the nitrogen that's in the atmosphere and convert that into sugars and amino acids and lipids. So in other words, the things that you're made of, fat and proteins and, you know, carbohydrates and so on, that are then available for these other organisms to eat. That would be a complete analogy to what's going on in the Earth, and I don't see why you shouldn't be able to do that. So what you do is you start to look at plants and algae as that interface between the raw materials on the planet and the sort of materials that other organisms, that animals and fungi and so on, need to be able to eat to then do their processes. So that's my grand vision.
So what kind of material will you be able to build on Mars or produce on Mars?
I think that you probably could produce just about anything that you could produce on the Earth if you're clever about it. Some things it may not be worth it because there's such great infrastructure. And some things it should be easy. So we're trying to develop technologies, particularly in my lab, that could be done independently. So an example that I gave tonight of something that we're doing right now is building habitats. So you think, well, habitats, the Apollo astronauts went to the moon and they lived in their, I jokingly call their tin cans, they lived in their lunar modules. And they're very tiny, they're about half the size of a prison cell. They're extremely tiny. But if you're on the moon for 3 days, it's an exciting adventure, probably the most exciting thing in your life. You're happy to live in a half a prison cell, but you're not going to want to do that for the 2.5 years that you're going to be likely to do a round trip to Mars. And you're going to want to be able to build structures that you can then use for production of food and fuels and storing things and so on. So one of the things that we're working on in my lab right now is using fungal mycelia to grow structures. Now, what fungal mycelia are the parts of mushrooms that are under the ground. They're similar to roots for mushrooms. But it turns out that if you make a mold that you then fill with food scraps, whether it's coffee grounds on the earth or garden scraps or whatever, paper waste, that these fungal mycelia will grow on it, these thread-like things, and fill the structure. And then you can bake that and or freeze it, and you have materials that you then can use to make a table or a whole habitat or a chair. Some people are actually using fungal mycelia to make imitation leather. So there are all sorts of cool things that you could do just using fungal mycelia. What are they going to eat? Well, again, you could use an alga or a cyanobacterium, which is another kind of microbe that photosynthesizes, to be able to be that interface between the raw materials on the planetary surface and the materials that the fungal mycelia needs to eat. So there's one example. We've also done proof of concepts in my lab of making bioplastics, which you could do very exciting things, obviously, on Mars once you can make plastic. We've had projects where we extract metals with great precision, taking advantage of the proteins in cells that bind very specific metals, whether it's copper or zinc or nickel or magnesium or iron. You can do that sort of thing. And by the way, all these are useful technologies for the Earth. I have a project.
How are they useful?
Well, what's interesting is that my colleagues who are synthetic biologists on the Earth have to think immediately when they have a new technology, how this might disrupt the current political situation or economic situation. If they form a company, are they going to be able to get investors? Are they going to be able to turn a profit quickly? What about the existing industries? You know, are they going to be cheaper than buying sugarcane from Brazil and making something some other way or whatever? I don't worry about any of those things. That's not my problem. My biggest concern for economics for space exploration is upmass. So in other words, it's extremely expensive to launch against gravity. And so any time that we can make something less massive, that's what saves us money. So instead of maybe a 50 kilogram, 100 kilogram piece of equipment on a bench, I want a 5 kilogram piece of equipment. And that means you may have to do things radically different. I mentioned earlier today that Henry Ford said people don't want a faster horse, they want a car. It's that idea that at some point you may have to jump to a radically new technology. And my point is that once you do that with the conceit of space exploration, why not then apply that to an Earth-based model? So if I'm going to push for miniaturization of a piece of equipment or a technique, how important this could then be for, say, point-of-care diagnostics in remote areas on planet Earth. You go to a remote village, instead of having to bring a lot of equipment with you or having to mail samples, you may then have something that's very tiny in your hand that can do diagnostics right there on the spot.
Do you see any dangers in the technology of synthetic biology?
Well, many people are concerned about the dangers, and there's certainly the potential for danger anytime that you're doing things with a genetic system. But that's true of any field of engineering. You know, I don't need to point out to your audience that there are many things that you can do with electricity and many other things for the good and for evil. Nuclear powers, you know, certainly comes to mind. And I think the synthetic biology is the same way. Yes, if someone set their mind to it, you could do really horrible things because there's certainly organisms that produce toxins and everything else. You could disrupt food supplies. You could do all sorts of things. But conversely, you can also do an enormous amount of good. We have the potential to cure many diseases. We have the potential, again, to reduce our carbon footprint, which also then helps our global climate. We have the potential to do things in very tailor-made, very important ways, recycling metals, reducing environmental impact. So I think the potential good of this technology is unbelievable. For about the last 15 years, there's been a synthetic biology competition for college students. There are now also some high school students and some postgraduate teams as well. This year, this what's called the iGEM competition, Internationally Genetically Engineered Machine Competition, has roughly 350 teams. And all the teams work on building something with synthetic biology. But what's interesting, and perhaps unlike many other engineering competitions that we have in the world, this one requires the students to sit back and look a little bit at what they call human practices, at the safety and the ethical implications of what they're doing. So I think that it's been a very good field in trying to make sure that the practitioners and certainly the students coming up are aware of both the positive and the negative parts of their technology so that they're able to steer their research into ways where they will avoid the pitfalls that could happen otherwise.
So this technology is not in the future, it's actually now.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I said something to one of our NASA technologists a few years ago when we were talking about it, and he said, well, do you really think any of these things will ever happen? And I looked at him, I said, everything I just told you about undergraduates in my lab have already done.
So what is the most crazy thing that you have seen so far with synthetic biology?
Ooh, I don't know what the craziest thing was. One of the things that I'm kind of excited about that was brought to my lab by an undergraduate at Brown University, Simon Vecchione, a few years ago, and has now finished his PhD on it, is being able to take DNA, so the double helix that codes for your information, make a few changes, not in an organism, but now out in a plastic tube, that allows silver atoms to be incorporated into that DNA double helix in specific places and use that to make an electrical wire one atom in thickness. Now, is that cool? So you're using biology as a structural material, nanotechnology, and imagine how infinitely cheaper it is to do that than to try to do this in a nanotechnology way that people normally do. In fact, there are people who have tried to then coat virus cells with gold to make little particles. Or I know one of the iGEM teams at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands a few years ago coated bacteria so that they deposited silica on the outside. Now, we have groups of algae called diatoms that live in the ocean that deposit silica. We have sponges that deposit silica and so on. But imagine engineering a bacterium to coat itself with silica. What you get are very perfect little glass beads out of it. I mean, so this is amazing potential out there for all sorts of cool things.
Sort of mind-breaking.
It is, and I could go on, and it's really hard to pick what the most exciting thing is because there's so many things. One of the things I'm very excited about and have been for a few years is sponges. And you think, oh, sponges, you know, something maybe you use in the shower. But a living sponge is basically a filtration machine. It takes water in constantly, it pumps it through its body, it pulls out nutrients, and then it excretes what's left. But there are bacteria inside the sponge that can help pull out some of the material. So what if you think of the sponge sort of like a computer and you think of the bacteria as apps? So you design an app to pull out maybe a specific metal or a toxin or whatever that you're trying to concentrate or use that now to be a water purification machine. I mean, isn't that cool? The sort of stuff that you can do is unbelievable. And again, I'm well aware that this could be used for evil, but I think that that's true of any engineering discipline, and I think that the good far, far outweighs it.
Cool. Thank you.
Let me add one thing that I didn't mention earlier tonight, is there are some people, our lab has done a little bit of this, that are starting to use cell-free systems. So think about it. It would be almost like going to the computer store and you buy a Mac and you say, well, you know, I really don't need the screen because I've got something else I'm going to plug it into. And maybe I don't need the keyboard because I have an external one. And maybe I don't really need this outer metal because that just adds weight. And you sort of strip it down. It's a little bit like that with the cell-free system. You're taking the parts of a cell that you really need to maybe make a protein. So you say, well, I need to have a ribosome, which translates the information from RNA into a protein, and I need maybe DNA in a way to make that into RNA. So I need a few enzymes, a few structural things, but I don't need things like a cell membrane anymore, and I don't need maybe a chloroplast or whatever else is in the cell. I just need it to be able to make proteins. So this field is at the point that some of these cell-free systems you can now just buy commercially. You just send them money. You can buy some of this usually on dry ice. But imagine that you could take some of this, dry it down, and we're talking about very, very tiny quantities. And then I send this up to, say, Mars or the moon, and it's time for astronauts to get their tetanus vaccination, just say. So what we do is we send that coding information, as we described before. Maybe they make the DNA on the planet. You stick some of the DNA and some water into your dried cell components, and in an hour you have the tetanus vaccine. Why not?
That's even more mind-blowing.
None of this is impossible. None of this is that far in the future. The only thing that seems to be far in the future is actually getting it to Mars.
Or getting back.
Well, I think it was Elon Musk who said that he wanted to die on the planet, but not on impact.
Okay, engine stop. Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed. That's one small step for man, one
Mankind. Her mødte du Lynn Rutschel fra NASA, der fortalte om syntetisk biologi på Mars. Lynn Rutschel mødte jeg på Tech-festivalen i København sidste år, og sådan en Tech-festival er der jo under opsejling igen, så det skal du bare holde øje med. Jeg linker til Lynn Rutschel og hendes forskning fra techtopia.dk. Du har lyttet til Techtopia, der har været en tur i verdensrummet. Du kan finde mere information på techtopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henriksnabelag@techtopia.dk. Forvent ikke lige et svar med det samme, fordi jeg holder egentlig sommerferie. Du kan også deltage i diskussionen på Facebook, på vores Facebook-gruppe Techtopia. Backstage hedder den. Og du kan følge programmet på Twitter, @techtopia.dk. Og med det er der jo bare at sige på genhør, god rumfart og god sommer. Techtopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi. Den er udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Teknologiens Mediehus, HI-messen, AM Hub, Index Award, Innovation Center Danmark og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Techtopia.